Now it is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. Please offer a warm Valley Group welcome to GS.
Hi guys, I'm Gia, I'm an alcoholic. I used to say that I was a social drinker with bad luck, that was my claim to fame, but I realize now I am an alcoholic. The one they talk about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Hopefully you guys will hear something that you might relate to. That's what this deal is. We can't seem to reach another alcoholic unless we're an alcoholic and we share our experience, strength, and hope with someone else. So usually I like to start out kind of on a light note because you guys just love when people read stuff.
Yay.
So this is my deal. This is how I drink. And if you guys relate, you might have a drinking problem. So these are the five stages of drunkenness. Stage one, you're smart. You suddenly become an expert on every subject in the known universe. You know everything, and you want to pass on your knowledge to anyone who will listen. At this stage, you are always right, and of course, the person you are talking to is very wrong. The argument gets even more interesting when both parties are smart. So, stage two. This is good looking. I was this a lot of the time. At this stage, you realize you are the best looking person in the entire bar and that people fancy you. You can go up to a perfect stranger knowing he or she fancies you and really wants to talk to you. Bear in mind that you are still smart, so you can talk to that person about any subject under the sun.
That's right.
Stage three. Rich. This is when you suddenly become the richest person in the world. You can buy drinks for the entire bar because you have an armored truck full of money parked right outside. You can also make bets at this stage because, of course, you're smart. So naturally, you'll win all your bets. And it doesn't matter how much you bet because you're rich. You also buy drinks for everyone you fancy because you now are not only rich, but the best-looking person in town as well. Stage four, coming down to the wire, bulletproof. You are now ready to pick fights with anyone and everyone, especially those with whom you have been betting or arguing. This is because nothing can hurt you. At this point, you also can go up to the partners of the people you fancy and challenge them to a battle of the wits or money. You have no fear of losing because you're smart, you're rich, and hell, you're better looking than they are anyway. And then stage five, invisible. This is the final stage of drunkenness. At this point, you can do anything because no one can see you. You dance on the table to impress the people you fancy because the other people in the room cannot see you. You are also invisible to the people who want to fight you. You can walk through the street singing at the top of your lungs because no one can hear you either. And because you're still smart, you know all the words. That is totally my favorite thing because that's how I drank and that's how my thought process was. So, if you guys don't know why you're an alcoholic, I suggest you get the big book. Because the answers are in the big book. I have no answers. I just follow what the big book says. And I want to read one last little thing here. It comes out of the doctor's opinion. And this is the greatest chapter. And it tells you why you drank. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented until they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. drinks which they see others taking with impunity. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomena of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over. Unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. And that psychic change for me came through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was the only way that I had that psychic change. You know, my story is different from others. My story is the same as others. I drank more than some people. I drank less than some people. It doesn't matter how much you drank. What matters was what happened when you drink. And that's what my deal is. When I drank, I developed that phenomena of craving and that mental obsession. And I went through life with that spiritual malady, and that's what got me in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hated God. I hated you. Everything was everybody else's fault. I saw no hope. I was helpless. I was hopeless. And the only sense of comfort and ease I got was when I drank a few drinks. And then everything was okay. And I can remember, you know, just opening that bottle, because my drug of choice was vodka, you know, the big plastic 1.75 liters of vodka, you know, in the plastic bottle, because I was always dropping stuff. So when I dropped it, it wouldn't drink, you know, it wouldn't break. So those were the greatest invention. You know, I came from a family that alcoholism runs in the family on my mother's side. So there wasn't any alcohol in the home. So I wasn't exposed to an alcoholic, tragic childhood growing up. You know, I felt loved, but I felt different. Nothing ever satisfied me. I tried to be the best student, and that wasn't enough. I tried to be the best swimmer and hold all these records at Redwood. It wasn't enough. I didn't feel like I could do enough to become important, and I always wanted to be important, and I wanted to please my parents and make them proud of me. That was my goal in life. So, you know, I ended up being a good student, being a great swimmer, and I had a younger brother that made it real easy for me to be, you know, mom and dad's favorite growing up, because, you know, he drank and did drugs and screwed up, and so it kind of like helped me out, you know, growing up. You know, he got a 2-year chip tonight, and that was a miracle, because 2 years ago he was killing himself and dying. And these are just, you know, emotions of, I'm just so grateful that this program was here for him when he made the decision to put down that bottle and get some help. Yeah, I didn't drink too much in high school. I had a couple drinks, 15, 16, but my first time I drank, it was that cherry sloe gin, and my friend brought it to a party, and it tastes like grenadine, because I was the one always ordering, you know, the Roy Rogers or the Shirley Temples, and that's what it tasted like. So I sat there and I drank this whole bottle, and she's sitting there, save me some. So I mean, the first time I drank almost the whole bottle, and I was sick the rest of the night. And I feel so bad, these people's bathrooms were just red. You know, I was thrown up in the bathtub all over, and it looked like a murder scene. It did. So I said to myself, that was not any fun. So I didn't drink again until I started college. My family was very strict. So when I went to college, I had all this freedom, and I thought, well, I can do anything I want. So, you know, living in the dorms, and I had a roommate that loved to party, and so I started drinking, and it wasn't too long that I found myself, I could outdrink everyone. I had this gift. They used to call me in college Fish, and they'd see me across, you know, the campus, and they'd be like, you know, a little fish. And that was my claim to fame, and that was my thought process. I'm cool. I can outdrink everybody, last man standing kind of deal, and all the guys wanted to drink with me because I didn't pass out or want to go home early. You know, I was a great buddy to drink with. And I ended up quitting the swim team. And I don't, you know, I look at these things now because I have some insight. But something I worked so hard for to get into college, and I quit because I wanted to drink. So real early on, alcohol became more important than anything else. My second year, I joined a sorority because I knew they wanted to drink like I did. So I wasn't swimming. I wasn't really going to class. I made sure my classes were on Tuesday and Thursday. And then I was usually hungover on Thursday, so I went to school on Tuesdays. And it got to the point where I was kind of getting miserable, and I thought, you know, I need to do something. So I thought, well, my first geographic, the best thing I could do is go to another college because, you know, UC Santa Barbara is my problem. That, you know, those people there. So I went to an all-Christian college because I thought, well, that'll straighten me up. And those people drank as much as the people over in Santa Barbara, you know, and I couldn't get away from it. But in all reality, I didn't want to get away from it because I hung around the people that drank. So my first experience with Alcoholics Anonymous or any trouble with the law, because I'm very law-abiding, is I got a couple DUIs in college. And I know it was because I had this really fast car. I had a 94 Trans Am, and the cops were jealous, and they didn't like me. And because I was prettier and smarter and invisible and bulletproof and all those things, I thought I could get away with it. But I ended up going to jail. And I thought to myself, God really hates me. You know, why are you doing this to me? And right after the first one, it wasn't within another year, and I got the second one. And this one, I had to go to real jail. It wasn't just the holding cell. So I ended up going to Sybil Brand County Jail. I don't know, it's not there anymore, but it's probably one of the toughest jails for women. And it was a rude awakening. And I remember sitting in that holding cell because my mommy came to drop me off to go to jail. And I'm sitting in the holding cell, and there's prostitutes and drug addicts and drug dealers and really mean people. And I'm sitting there, and I'm like, how the hell did I get myself into this? You know, why is God so angry with me? And it's just amazing how blind and insane I was. So this gal, you know, she asked me, you want some crack? And I didn't know what that was. And and she pulled it out. I said, you're not supposed to do that in here, you know, because I'm law-abiding. And she kicked me. And I thought, oh, crap. I've seen what they do in the movies to people like me, so I'm keeping my mouth shut. So I sat on my bed for the next 5 days, because I stayed 5 days. I was supposed to get released and work, and they lost my papers, so I had to stay there. And I sat on my bunk guarding my house shoes and my toothbrush because they wanted that. And I didn't take a shower because if you'd have seen me about 35 years ago, I saw what they did to women in jail, and I was strictly dickly, so I kept my clothes on. I didn't want any part of that. So anyways, this was my first experience with incomprehensible demoralization. The nastiest, it's just such a nasty word. Ugh, my mommy came to visit me in jail, and I'm sitting behind the glass there. And remember, I wanted to make her proud of me, you know, be the best daughter, everything. And she sat there with tears in her eyes. And I remember feeling this low. And I thought to myself, I guess I'm not making her proud of me, you know. And I felt like a piece of crap. And I vowed, you know, I'm not drinking ever again. I don't want to do this. So the judge told me, you have a choice of going to rehab for 30 days or you can stay in jail for 30. And I needed a shower. So I chose the rehab. So then after 5 days I was released and my mom put me on a plane to Hazleton, Minnesota. And I got to, you know, get some good recovery information because I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I was just there on vacation because I'd studied and I took finals and I was tired and I just needed to get away. So I was there for 30 days and I wouldn't say that I was an alcoholic. And finally my counselor came, you know, called me into her office and said, you know, the whole time you're here, you haven't done any work. You're getting in trouble because you're shooting kites to the guys. You're doing all this stuff, and you're not serious about this. And this is life and death. And I thought to myself, this woman's crazy, but I'm not going back to jail. So I said, okay, I'm an alcoholic. And I was an alcoholic for 30 days. And I, you know, it amazes me when you're not hopeless and helpless yet. I don't remember going to any AA meetings, but I know we had to have. All I remember was playing pool, going to the comedy club in Minneapolis, all the stuff like that, because I was just crazy. So I stayed sober for a year. I moved back here, started coming to the Alano Club, and that was in 1990, and I judged and criticized. I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't want any part of it because you guys have lost everything. I hadn't even gotten anything to lose yet. I had my whole life ahead of me. So I thought, nah, I'm not doing it. I don't have a problem. I'm only 22 or 23, however old I was. I don't have a problem. So I stayed sober for a year, and then I started hitting the bars again because I was a bar drinker, and I loved the lights and dancing. You know, I was a solid gold dancer, by the way. I don't know if you know that. So I was very impressive on that dance floor and loved, you know, there was a place up in San Jose called the Saddle Rack. And I don't know if that's there, but that was my favorite place. Throw me back in that barber chair, you know, and throw some, you know, alcohol down my throat. And I mean, that's the way I was. So I was drinking for another, 7 years, 8 years. And I thought, well, I don't want to get in trouble anymore with the law. So if you can't beat them, you need to join them. So I went to the police academy. And I just thought of it because this guy I drank with was a CO and it sounded like a good idea. So I went to the police academy and ended up getting hired at Tulare County Sheriff's. So some of you people look familiar. And I worked at Bob Wiley. And I met my husband in jail. Or my ex-husband. But he wasn't an inmate. He was another officer or deputy. Okay? So this was the kind of decisions I made when I was drinking. And I'm not proud of them because I feel like a piece of crap and it's not right. But, you know, he was married and I convinced him that I was the better prize. So he left his wife and we got married. And he drank a lot more than I did. And that's probably where I crossed that line. And I started drinking in the morning. I started drinking all day long. And we drank and we had the best time, I thought. And then that Jekyll and Hyde started coming out. And he'd say one thing, and then that stupid son of a bitch, the fight was on. And, you know, there was a lot of emotional abuse. There was some physical abuse. And after the physical abuse, I pretty much lost all respect for him. And I thought to myself, you know, if someone who's supposed to love you, because I never even been hit or beat up on the streets. And then on my honeymoon, I got beat up by him. And so I thought, you know, that's it. I'm just doing my thing. Screw that dude. And so I just drank more because I was just miserable. And I drank to escape. And finally, it got to the point where I couldn't do it anymore. So I kicked him out. And I start drinking around the clock, and I realize I'm still miserable, and the son of a bitch is gone. I'm only here. So there's got to be something wrong with me. Oh, well, so I just kept drinking. And then the depression started setting in. You know, that spiritual malady they talk about. And I wanted to die. I wanted to kill myself. And I tried a few different times killing myself. And I remember the last time I tried, I was sitting in the garage. I was living in the country in Exeter. And I had a irrigation hose because I had an acre of oranges. And I was sitting in the garage with that hose, you know, and in the car. And I'm listening to George Strait because it sounded like a good idea at the time. And it's June, July, it's 120. And I have my big tumbler of vodka with just a little splash of Diet 7-Up. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, this is it. I've just had it. And then I ran out of vodka. And so I went back into the house, poured it, went back out into the garage and sat in my car, drinking, feeling more depressed. I wish this carbon monoxide would build up. And I ran out of vodka. And I did this like a half a dozen times, and finally I thought, this isn't going to work. So I thought to myself, what can I do? And I thought, well, I need some cheering up. So the only thing that used to cheer me up back then was Jerry Springer. So I went inside and I turned Jerry Springer on and I was good to go for a little while. But that's what I did. My last 8 months of drinking, I was miserable. I wanted to die. So I pretty much stayed at home drinking by myself because at that point I didn't trust myself. I'm one that I would leave with strangers. Hey, let's go party. Okay, I don't know who you are. You're probably not going to rape me because I'm bulletproof. And so I'd leave. And then I'd wake up and I'd be like, God, that was so stupid and I know better. Why do I keep doing this stuff? Why am I such a bad person? That's what I thought I had, a disease of being a bad person. I didn't realize it was alcoholism. So the last attempt I tried to kill myself was with a gun. And I had it in my mouth. And my brother and my mom came by because they were worried about me. And they hadn't heard from me. And I remember running all over the house frantic. I had to hide this gun because if they, you know, saw me with it, they were going to have me committed. And I thought at that point I really was crazy. I didn't know the effects of alcoholism. I thought I was bipolar, depressed, whatever. So at that moment, I made a decision to get help. And I remembered because I had that court card, you know, a decade prior, that there was a solution. I didn't want the solution at that time, but I wanted it this time. And that was October 14th, 2002. And I haven't found it necessary to drink a drop of alcohol after that. So I just celebrated 14 years. Well, I'll tell you what, it hasn't been easy. It's been work. I went down to a rehab in Southern California, and I remember being on that plane, and I was flying over Visalia, and I got really scared because I knew for the first time my life was going to be different. I knew what to expect, you know, drinking all day long, being pissed off, being depressed. I knew that. That was comfortable. But what wasn't comfortable is thinking I was going to have to live the rest of my life without alcohol, which was my best friend. What was I going to do? How was I going to cope? How was I going to talk to people? How was I, you know, all these thoughts. And then I know this was the first spiritual awakening I had. It was God talked to me and he said, it's going to be okay. And right then some warmth came over me. And I was comforted. And I knew at that point it was going to be okay. And I was desperate enough, willing, open-minded to do whatever they were going to tell me to do. So I went to that rehab open-minded. I walked through that front door, and whatever they told me to do, I was going to do it, and then some, because I'm an overachiever. And they tell me you get a trophy at the end if you do, you know, the most work, I thought. But they told me to get a sponsor. So you go to AA meetings down there, and I remember I went to the Alano Club in Marina Del Rey, and there was this lady named Tony. My ex-husband's name was Tony, so I thought, like, God brought her to me, right? And she was talking, and I could relate. I could relate to that hopelessness and that helplessness and that desperation and not wanting to drink, but had to drink. And I thought to myself, I want her as my sponsor. You know, she had like 17 years, and her husband ran a recovery home, and I thought, okay, so I was kind of shy. I know that's hard to believe. But I went up to her and I said, hey, do you think you can sponsor me? I'm in Promises Rehab and they told me I need to get a sponsor, but I really relate to that. She said, sure. And I'm like, well, that was easy. So she started taking my roommate at the time, her and I, to women's meetings down there. And started working the steps and getting into the book. And even though my life was crappy here and I knew there was stuff that was going to, I was going to have to make some choices back here, it was still better than drinking and being miserable. And I began to feel better physically. And so I thought to myself, man, I don't want to go back to that Visalia, so maybe I'll stay down here and move. You know, that was always my thing, just run away. So I stayed there for about 4 months longer because I went into a halfway house. And I ended up, they told me, get into service because if you want to stay sober, you got to be in service. Just like Bill is, all the time. That's why he's still sober. And one of these days, have Bill tell you the story about when I gave him his 30-day chip. That's a neat story. I love you, Bill. So I started secretarying a meeting down there. And then when I had to move back up here, there used to be a noon meeting here on Saturdays, a powder puff meeting, ladies meeting. So I started secretarying that. And I got a sponsor up here, and I started working the steps. And things got okay. I was never on that pink cloud, though, because my first year they tell you, you know, don't make any changes. But out of necessity, I had to go through a divorce because that guy was still drinking. He was telling me I was a bum, that I was a drunk and would never stay sober. And I wanted to stay sober more than I wanted to stay married to the SOB, so I had to divorce him. Then my dad got sick and needed a kidney transplant, needed a kidney. And I thought to myself, God, I'm doing the right thing. Why are you putting all these obstacles in my life? I'm finally not drinking. But you know what? Even though things get thrown at you, curveballs, I just did what the next indicated thing was. We all got tested for kidney. I have two other brothers. And we all were matches. So he not only had to pick from one kidney, he had three to pick from. So that thing that my mom used to tell me that the postman was my father, I knew that was untrue. So my younger brother donated his kidney. And so things like that, even though they were not positive experiences and causing heartache, it worked itself out. Because it's God's will. And I had to learn that here. That no matter what's going on, I can either accept it or I can fight it. And it says in the big book, you know, we get here and we cease fighting everything and everyone. And that's been my hardest thing to do. Because, you know, I'm one of those that I make shit happen. You know, if I'm going to do something, it's going to be done. And I'm that director they talk about in the book. And if you guys just do what I want, your lives are going to be perfect. But it doesn't work that way. So I had to realize that I had to step aside and I had to allow God to work in my life. And I've got a few more minutes, but what I want to talk about is what's very important to me is I was here for 8 years. I was going to meetings. I was judging and criticizing. And I was miserable again. And they talk about that. You can have untreated alcoholism in sobriety. And that's what I had. And I thought to myself, why do I want to not drink and be miserable? I might as well frickin' drink because this is no fun. So I was at the ice house and this gal was talking about feeling the same way. She had 15 years sobriety and she hated life. And what happened was she went through the book and did the steps again as they were exactly outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she talked about that higher power and the spiritual connection and how important that spiritual connection is. Because I believe in God, it's just I don't like to rely on Him because you can't see Him. And it's scary, the unknown. So I asked her to be my sponsor. And I went back through that big book and I did the steps exactly how they were outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I put myself in the pages. You know, I asked the questions. Do I think this program will work for me? Do I think I can do this on my own? Can I do it without a higher power? Can I do it without that psychic change? All this stuff. And I realized that this whole thing is spiritual. And if I don't have that spiritual connection, I'm going to stay miserable. I have to rely on Him. I have to ask Him for help. And I have to humble myself. Because I'm one that everything's okay, but inside I'm dying. And I'm tired of living that way. So what I did was when I went through the steps, I finally gained some self-awareness of why I pushed people away. Because they're going to leave anyways. So I would, you know, subconsciously keep people at a distance because I was fearful. Because I didn't want to get hurt. So I thought if I had a wall up, that I wouldn't get hurt. And people that have been around here a long time has seen me through all this up and down, and I wouldn't have people come and approach me because they were scared, because I was miserable, and I put that wall up because I didn't want to have emotions. I didn't want people to love me because if you guys love me, you might find out what kind of person I really was. And this is all just my distorted thinking because my alcoholism wants to tell me this bullshit. It wants me out there drinking and killing myself. But my God, luckily, kept me sober through that miserable time. A lot of people don't make it. They go out and drink. Luckily, the obsession was removed when I walked in that rehab, and I never had it since. And that's what saved my ass through that untreated alcoholism. So I did the steps. I got back into service. I started sponsoring people. And I take them through the book and we use a guide. And I mean, it is the neatest thing to experience other women grow and gain the knowledge and the self-awareness of why they drank. And they can get well and they can recover. Because it says in the book, we can recover from a seamless, hopeless state of mind and body. We can recover But it takes work, and it's not easy. You know, a year and a half ago, my dad passed away, and I wanted to die again. But I went to more meetings, and I got busy and started working the steps with someone. And I thought, man, if I was ever going to drink again, it's because I lost a parent. But I didn't have to. You guys were here for me. You don't ever have to drink again if you don't want to. But you have to make that decision. We have a choice today. When we're drinking, we have no choice. So I hope you guys come aboard, buy into the deal, do the deal, and get the gifts that recovery has to offer. Because things do get better. They get different, but they get better. But you don't have to live in that self-prison, you know, that bondage of self. You can go down the street and look people in the eye. You don't have to look behind thinking, you know, are they going to get me? You can have some pride in yourself. You can have self-worth. All those things come back tenfold. I promise you that. I'm Gia. I'm an alcoholic. All right.